Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to join this debate. And it's a very lively one, which David and Nancy have already set off. And let me begin by saying what a privilege it is that I may perhaps be succeeding John Selborne in here as the chairman of the FST. The trustees have to decide, but I very much hope it will be possible. And I myself have appreciated over the years the fantastic debates and events that the Foundation has held. And this is one of the most important ones. So, what are universities for? Let me first cover a kind of angle to which I felt particularly exposed when I was the minister. I always felt you got so bogged down in how they were paid for, what the financial benefits were, that occasionally people thought, and Stefan Collini certainly thought this, that all you could ever do was talk about the plumbing of this building and never describe the architecture. You were endlessly bogged down in immediate practical effects and was never able to take a few steps back and admire and appreciate the university as an institution in its own right. So there are some purists who would just say, well, the university doesn't need to be judged by any kind of utilitarian test. The university is a worthwhile institution in its own right, and they are fantastic institutions. Of course, it is the case that universities, however, would never, with the sceptical intelligence and inquiring nature of their staff and researchers, ever allow any other institution they were researching to get away with claiming they had inherent value in their own right. They'd never accept that from anyone else. So universities shouldn't be surprised that other people apply those criteria to universities themselves. What are they for? And I'm going to give you a short list, which I'm going to kind of present as a historical narrative, because I think over the centuries, universities have grown more and more roles. And I would start, oddly enough, with something that I don't think has been mentioned yet, which is simply the conservation of knowledge and information. It is no accident that certainly for many of our historic universities, their biggest, proudest, most prestigious building is the library. And in turbulent and difficult times, the place where a body of knowledge and understanding and some of the cultural and intellectual objects of a society were preserved was their university. And oddly enough, I think this type of role is, if anything, becoming more significant again today. Historic data sets, objects preserved just because they were old, but which you now have a capacity to use science to analyze in ways that nobody would have ever envisaged before. So there is a custodianship, conservation, trusteeship role for the university. Secondly, of course, teaching. And increasingly, teaching at the frontiers of knowledge and research, but we should be aware that for many centuries, people didn't think of universities as a place for research. Indeed, they weren't at all clear whether knowledge advanced much at all. You could learn a lot by studying Aristotle and Plato, and insofar as there was an account of how knowledge advanced, it was by the occasional solitary genius. So teaching was not necessarily at the frontier of scholarship, but that has increasingly become the case and become, as we heard from Nancy, one of the distinctive features of the university. And knowledge in a variety of forms, and the English debate has certainly, I think, had suffered in a way from a classical distinction between liberal knowledge and menial education, where the liberal knowledge was the knowledge that a free man, it normally was a man, a free man would be able to participate in and share without requiring it for some ulterior utilitarian purpose. Hence one of the great classic definitions of a university, a place where nothing useful is taught. So there was a school of thought that if it was useful, then it was vocational education and not for the university. The university was for the education of a liberal mind, which was not driven by the requirement to practice a trade or profession. And that still lives on sometimes in views about what universities could or cannot do. But I think that distinction now does a lot of damage to universities, because of course people can study the liberal arts for their own sake, but almost half of all university students are now getting a license to practice. They are studying for a profession or activity. So there's teaching, and teaching at the frontier of scholarship. And that was, right through the 19th century, pretty much the limit of what universities in England did. Humboldt had envisaged this new role of the research-intensive university, the research university in Germany. But as visiting Oxford and talking to Matthew Arnold records the conversation, asking him what he thought of Oxford, he said, "I think Oxford is a very distinguished gymnasium," by which he meant in Oxford people were taught, they didn't do research, they went to proper university, but they're a very good gymnasium. So it was only, we're having this debate at the right moment, it was only the experience of the First World War and the policy debates leading to the Haldane Report, published in 1918, where universities, thirdly, took on a role in research and advancing knowledge. And the crucial moment in this was actually a media campaign driven by Britain's frustration that America stayed neutral in the First World War for so long. So people wanted to... I couldn't understand, given our close historic ties to the US, why it was neutral. And there was some investigation as what we hadn't realized there was any German influence on America. Why was America purely neutral? And one of the crucial explanations was the discovery that American academics who wished to do any postgraduate research, who wanted to get a postgraduate qualification, which was necessary for promotion in the US, and very few were available in the US, you could do some, they went to Germany. A third of the senior ranks of Harvard were people with doctorates from German universities. And there were no doctorates in English universities because England didn't do research. So the Foreign Office summoned our university leaders to challenge them to deal with this Germanic influence on America by creating postgraduate qualifications that will be a rival attraction for American students in competition with German doctorates. Hence the first DPhil Oxford, 1917, and the flourishing of... That was the moment when universities started taking on a research role. And 1918 was a crucial moment in the history of universities because, of course, very astutely, when the Foreign Office summoned the vice-chancellors to ask them to take on this role, it was the vice-chancellor of Bonn University who chipped in a way that I recognise from vice-chancellors to this day. He said, of course, Foreign Secretary, we would do stand ready to take on this role, but when these overseas students arrive to study for these doctorates, they may be shocked by the poor quality of the facilities. We do need to invest in giving them a worthwhile experience. So it's very important there should be some public funding so that this is a worthwhile experience for our overseas visitors. And, of course, the origins of HEFCE go back to university grants introduced in 1918. The origins of UUK go back to the Committee of Vice-Chancellor and Principals created in 19 in order to negotiate with the government to secure the grants. So a lot happened at the end of the First World War, and one thing was becoming the location of R&D. And again, just as I said on teaching, this tension between the liberal and the menial, the pure and the applied... And it's very important that to this day we keep space in the university both for blue skies research and for applied research. Sometimes, of course, the blue skies research turns out to be useful. And indeed, one of the most elegant ways of resolving any tension between them is the great Flexner observation on the usefulness of useless knowledge. I had the privilege of talking to a Nobel Prize winner. Actually, he got his Nobel Prize in economics, but he was really Robert Allman, but he'd really done his work in maths, who told me how he had deliberately, he'd wrestled with a problem to do with the shape of knots, the asphericity of knots, and had been proud of publishing a paper of no practical value whatsoever, entirely to do with how you could model and offer a mathematical account of the shape of these knots. And he thought, I've done it. Nobody can find any possible use for this research. Until his grandson phoned him from university to say, Granddad, you know they're using your formula to help in modelling DNA. And he cursed. He'd tried to write something that was totally useless and irrelevant, but had proved incapable of adding to the stock of understanding in a way that was not subsequently of use. So the distinction may, over time, become one that is hard to sustain. But anyway, they've become a location of research, and there's a paradox here, which is that although in England we were late to the party of being a base for R&D, Germany had been doing it for a century, if you look at the figures, the evidence now, we now have in Britain an unusual concentration of our R&D activity in universities. We have a different distribution of R&D than many other countries, with a higher proportion done in universities and rather less in publicly funded labs independent of universities than Germany itself. In Germany now you have the Max Plancks, the Fraunhofers, the Helmholtz network, and what essentially we have done, the British strategy, has been to have rather low levels of R&D spend as a percent of GDP, to have very low levels of R&D spend, publicly funded R&D spend outside universities, to have quite low levels of business R&D spend, but to put all our eggs in the basket of higher education-based R&D spend, where our levels of spend match that of the US and Germany. So we've got all our eggs in that basket. So, I said, conservation, trusteeship of knowledge and understanding, teaching, research, two more roles that have grown over time. A new role, well, an increasingly significant role, of, I would say, being the managing the transition to adulthood of young people. And I actually regard 1963 as the crucial moment. In 1963 was the last year, was the year when the last conscript left the British Army. In the post-war period, England had on average of 150,000 conscripts a year and 50,000 university students. And being conscripted into the army was the managed transition to adulthood. 1963, with the Robins expansion and the last conscript leaving the army, was the point, the pivot, when the university took on a role that had previously, for much of the 20th century, been military. And before that, being apprenticeships. And it's now a very significant role. As we know, 50% of young people go into university. And my view is there is no rival model. There is no alternative model for that kind of semi-supervised transition to adulthood. And although, and we can have a separate debate about apprenticeships, one of the crucial features of the historic apprenticeship was you left home to become an apprentice. And you often lived with the master. And the leaving home for the apprenticeship has pretty much collapsed. And now the leave home to go to university is one of the reasons why this has become so important. So fourth, managing the transition to adulthood. And the fifth role, which I think is the most recent and the most significant, and Nancy touched on it, which is in a global economy where there are very few institutions that you can trust. Trust, and David was talking about this, but trust to stay where they are. When the factory, however significant as a local employer, however deep the roots, there's always the chance that it'll be closed down or the Americans will take it over and decide it's not economic. The anchor institution, which both looks out and is significant in a global economy, but also is rooted in a place and has a place name in it, is the university. So the anchor institution in a global economy. And where if you are in a city where you can't really trust any other institution not to leave, with one exception I'll come to in a moment, the university becomes very significant. The exception is the cathedral. And I think one of the interesting examples of reversion is to the new role of the university is in some ways it is not unlike the function of the medieval university as the anchor institution in a global and integrated environment as Christendom was. And indeed, paradoxically, some of our great cities, cathedral cities, but which had no significant and sustained economic activity, are being transformed by investment in a university. Lincoln, Chester, Winchester, Chichester. These are places which are growing higher education. So that would be my list. I don't want to go on at great length. I think that the benefits which Nancy described, so those would be my five main answers to the question, what are they for? The benefits of university education, I think you can categorise along two dimensions. There are individual benefits and wider social benefits. There are economic benefits. And the other dimension is economic benefits and non-economic benefits. And any one, that gives you kind of four quadrants, and any one of them can be filled with empirical evidence. And it, because, of course, when you're looking at how you fund university, you focus on the individual economic benefits. That doesn't mean there aren't wider economic benefits. There are also individual non-economic benefits, and there are wider non-economic benefits. All of those categories are filled, and Nancy was absolutely right in what she said. These are when you identify these type of effects, especially for individuals, they're not just selection effects. There is a causal effect as a result of the experience going to university. For the future, I think there are three powerful forces shaping our universities in this country. Two of them are familiar to in many sectors of the economy. They are the digital revolution, and I do believe that in the future, online learning, and more than that, data analytics, is going to change teaching. The amount of data we're going to have about the teaching process is going to mean that pedagogy becomes a far more empirical, data-rich discipline than it has historically been. So I think the digital revolution is very important. Globalization is very important, with flows of students to and from universities from other countries, enriching the student experience, but also presenting new challenges. And then the third item on my list, speaking in this building, is one that I know Venki Ramakrishnan, the president of the Royal Society, cares about. He and I absolutely agree on this one, which is the challenge of excessive specialisation. When I look at the biggest problem in English education today, it is early specialisation. The 3A level model is heavily shaped by university admission practices, and I think it would be great if universities resume their role in providing an education in the liberal arts, which of course extends beyond what we would now call the humanities into scientific disciplines as well. I think those are the future challenges. I think I had better stop there, but if people do wish to ask me for my personal views about how we should fund them and the leaks from Philip Auger's report, I'm very happy if you press me to tell you what I think. Thank you very much indeed.